Well, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today for Give Me 5 Training 129, How to Write Successful Proposals, Part 1. I'm Scott Nolan, Give Me 5 Program Coordinator at Women Impacting Public Policy. The Give Me 5 Program was named after the 5% federal contracting goal set by Congress in 2000. The National Program for Women Impacting Public Policy and American Express Open, designed to provide business education tools for women business owners to help them apply for and secure federal procurement opportunities. And now on to the program. Today's training session will give you step-by-step instructions on the do's and don'ts on how to write winning proposals on federal government solicitations. You will learn in detail the content of RFP, understanding pricing tools, and whether to bid or not to bid. I'm pleased to introduce today's instructor, Barbara English. Barbara is president of English Solutions Incorporated. Barbara honed her 36 years meritorious federal contracting career with the Department of Defense, being handpicked as a principal procurement advisor to a two-star general on procurement issues and managing the most complex defense federal acquisition regulations on behalf of the Office of Secretary of Defense. She serves as panel member on Small Business Administration's E200 Executive Training for small business owners in Jacksonville, Florida, and serves as a board member on Jacksonville Chamber Entrepreneurial Small Business Division. She was named Top 50 Small Business Influencer in Jacksonville by Small Business Advantage magazine. And in 2011, she won her clients $6.1 million in federal government contracts. So, Barbara, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am so glad you're joining me for part one of this series. And I am going to indicate for you as I go along exactly what page I'm on so you can follow me. And right now I'm on slide 6 that has that very lovely picture of me, so my husband says. Okay, so with that, let's move to the next page and let me just give you a quick summary of what I'm going to be talking about. On page 7, of course, it has all of my information about my company. And then moving to page 8, it talks about the objectives for today. What I want to accomplish today is to get you prepared to successfully respond to solicitation. So today is all about preparation. Part 2 will be a lot more about an actual solicitation and all the things you need to be concerned about with respect to that. And then part 3 will be delving even deeper into being successful with solicitations and considering how you price your proposal and a number of other things related to that. So I certainly encourage you to attend, be a part of all three of these sections. But today is about preparation, mechanics, some do's and don'ts, and some questions. And Scott is extremely adept at taking your questions and letting me know what they are. So feel free anytime in this presentation to send him a question either on the chat box or on his email, and he will tell me about it right away, and I would be happy to answer it. I want you all to take advantage of the fact that for 36 years, this has been an area that I've delved into a whole lot. All right, let's starting with the slide that's called the key, which is slide 9. The real key to any solicitation is responding exactly to what is asked for. That's called being responsive. If you do not respond exactly, your time and effort in putting your proposal together could have resulted in it being put in the trash can. Let me give you an example. If it says, please do not send any more than 40 pages and you send 41, that would be considered non-responsive and your proposal would not be evaluated at all. So please take that word exactly literally because the government means it. All right, now I'm going to go through 10 steps for preparing your proposal in the best way. And this is slide 10. The first step is to please make a copy of the solicitation. And make a hard copy of the solicitation. You want to have an original that you keep in a file, and then you want to have a working copy. So you really need two copies, and you want to do that with every other document that comes along. Now, I'm sure that most of you are aware that the place to find these solicitations are in FBO.gov. And so once you find one in SBO.gov that you are interested in, put that on Watch This Opportunity. And if you've never watched the solicitation or know how to do it, go to the Help button on SBO.gov, and it'll tell you how to watch a solicitation. That's important because even though the solicitation may come out today, they may do 4, 5, or 6 revisions to it, and you're going to be responsible for responding to the entire RFP, including those changes. So that's what this last bullet is talking about when it says keep a copy of every document that comes in with that solicitation. So sometimes there, actually in more times than not, there are amendments to the original solicitation, and you want to be responsive to all of those. Okay, moving on to the next slide. The second step then is once you've got this huge document copied, then you're going to want to read it and literally read it 3 times. Most of the solicitations that you see out are more than 50 pages long. The typical RFP is about 100 pages long. And so there's just no way that you can grasp all of what is in 100 pages the first time you read it. So if you read it carefully 3 times, you will probably catch those very important points to be sure that you are responsive to what the government is asking for. Now, a number of those pages will be Federal Acquisition Regulation clauses. And they're going to be there a lot of times by reference. So you're going to see a FAR clause incorporated by reference, and the actual text of the clause won't be there for the majority of the FAR clauses that you see listed. And this site that you see here is the place to go find each one of those FAR clauses. It's important for you to find them. It's important for you to read them, because if you were awarded the contract the day after it's awarded, you're going to have to live up to those FAR clauses. So that's a part of that reading ahead of time that you really want to have under your belt so that you understand what your requirements are going to be prior to an award of the contract being made. And obviously then, because we're talking about so much paper, you're going to want to have a binder to put all of those papers in. Okay, moving to the next slide now and talking about the third step. This is really, really important. You're going to want to mark everything in the proposal that has an action. And there will be many of them, many of them. And it's best if you can to either use color highlighters or stick-on notes. I actually like the stick-on notes better than the highlighters. And what you want to do is, if you're going to use the colors, whether it's the highlighter or the sticky note, use 2 different colors, one for the actions to prepare the proposal, and then one for the actions that are going to be required once the contract is awarded. For example, there might be a section in RFP that says, I need you to deliver these items at this time, or I need you to perform this service once a month. Those are the kinds of things that would be required after the contract is awarded. You will also notice that a lot of the FAR clauses have time frames and actions after the contract is awarded. So you want to have one for what you have to do now and one for what you have to do later. All right, let's move on to step number 4. Excuse me. So once you've highlighted this document, you want to make a plan now of who's going to do what and who's going to assist with that. Typically, you would want to establish a team to prepare this response, even though it can be done by one person if that's the way you choose to do it. Actually, teaming with other folks in your office it will just make the process a little bit easier for you. But either way, you need to make a plan and list out the actual action steps that you prepared in step number 3 and assign responsibilities to a particular person and when it's due, and then always put one person in charge to kind of coordinate all of that activity. So let me give you an example of what I mean. You might assign someone to write the technical aspects of the proposal. You might assign someone else to manage the management aspects of the proposal. In other words, in the RFP, for example, it could say, I'd like to see your technical approach to how you're going to perform this work. I'd like to see your management approach. And then I also want to see your pricing. Another area could be, and I want all of the resumes of your key personnel or of all the resumes of the folks that are going to do the work. So that's four separate action steps there. And so that's what I mean by assigning responsibility to individuals to do that and then putting a time frame on that. Okay, let's move to step number five. And I'm on page 14 for those of you who are following. You then want to implement the action steps that you have put in place and within the time frames that you just assigned. Okay, now is the time to put all of that together and in proper sequence. That would be your step number six. And when you have done that, it's a good idea to tab it and to put it in a binder unless the solicitation tells you not to do that. And then you want to type a cover page and put the pertinent information about the solicitation in that cover page. And then you also want to be sure you sign where required. And I will tell you that one of the areas that I have seen a lot of businesses miss is signing the front sheet of the solicitation. That is, most RFPs that you see on SBO.gov will be in the form of a standard form 1449. And that document is called the solicitation, the contract, and the order. Okay, on that page, you always have to sign the offer on the front page of the SF-1449. A lot of folks miss that. If they're using the SF-1449 and the standard format for RFPs, Section L will be the instructions to the offeror for preparing the proposal. So you'll have to remember to follow the instructions in Section L and also to sign the front cover of the SF-1449 and anywhere else in Section L or in instructions where they ask for a signature. If you fail to do that, your proposal will be considered non-responsive and not considered any further. Okay, some other steps now. You also want to save a copy of your file. And I've moved to part two of step number six. And you also want to save another copy for your working file. You're going to find that you're going to be marking up your working file a lot. So you want to keep a clean copy and a copy that you can mark up and edit as you move through the process, okay? And I mentioned just a moment ago to bind it unless they tell you otherwise to do it. Binding it actually makes it nice, but don't do that unless the instructions say it's okay. And then you want to present an attractive proposal, and I would tell you not to go overboard with that. The government is not so much concerned with how pretty it looks. It needs to be attractive in terms of clean, nice black and white text and all of that, but it does not need to be elaborate. The government is more concerned with content than they are with how beautiful you made it. They just need it to be attractive enough to read, and that is the standard. Okay, let's move to Section 7. And because I'm not hearing from Scott, that kind of tells me that you all don't have any questions quite yet. And
not
that,
so far.
That's fine. But if you do have questions, by all means, please send them to Scott on email. And Scott, let's just have them, you give them their email one more time, just to be sure.
Sure. It's SNOLEN@WIP.org. That's SNOLEN@WIP.org. And I will forward those to Barbara.
Okay, and WIP is WIPP, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right, so we're in step number seven now, and you're going to want to start controlling the communications that come, right? And so if for some reason you're needing to have any contact at all with the contracting officer, you only want that contact to be with one person so you can kind of keep a control on everything. And when you have that contact, document what was said by fax, letter, or email, and keep a very good paper trail of that communication, okay? Now, we're in step 8. The RFP has been sent out on FBO.gov. You have fully prepared your package, and you have sent it in. And now you're in the middle of negotiation, right? And if you get to that point, it is very, very important that you ask, what are the procedures from this point on? So the minute you're contacted, ask the contracting officer, what is the process that they're planning to follow from this negotiation point up until award, so you have complete clarity on that, okay? Now, let me give an example of what I mean. The contracting officer may call and say, we'd like to start negotiations. You are in the competitive range, right? And if a contracting officer says that to you, you might not know what the competitive range is. So ask, what is the competitive range? What that means is that the contracting officer is in negotiation with you and several other contractors that they feel have a reasonable chance of getting the award. It likely also means that the contracting officer is going to tell you where your strengths are in the proposal, but also where your weaknesses are. And they will give you an opportunity during the negotiation process to clarify both your technical proposal as well as your pricing. So you want to be clear that you can do all of that and when you can do it. And so that's the importance of the clarifications, okay? Be very careful about not agreeing to anything that you, until you are absolutely sure of how it links to everything else. That's really, really important. And then make a list of everything you agreed to, right? And ask your customer in the end, when you are done with your negotiations, clarify that they are satisfied that you have answered all of the questions that they asked you. That's a very affirmative statement you want from the contracting officer. All right, and moving to step number 9. When you get the contract, because you did your very good homework, you want to compare the contract now to the list of things you agreed to be sure that they all match up, right? And once again, you want to make a copy of the contract and have a working file and also an original, so you've got a nice audit trail. And there's one thing, too, that's really, really important. The solicitation, the SF-1449 that you saw on FBO.gov that you use to prepare the solicitation is also the contract. So a lot of times when the contract itself is awarded, what you'll see on the front page of the SF-1449 is a block where the contracting officer will say, we accept your proposal dated whatever it is. It is now incorporated into this contract as a part of the contract, and they sign it, and then that's it. So you don't get a whole lot of different paperwork, generally speaking, from the SF-1449 that you are responding to. They basically sign the cover letter, incorporate your proposal, and say, that's it. So there isn't a whole lot of new documentation, generally speaking, that you see when the contract's awarded. And then, of course, the last step, then, is to perform the work as you agreed to. And if you recall, in some of the earlier steps, we talked about you're already having flagged all of the things that you're going to have to do to perform. So you want to go back to your working copy and look at all those sticky notes that you had with all those actions on them and be sure that you do those. And those FAR requirements are a very, very important piece of that, all those FAR clauses that are listed in there. You will find, as an example, on day one of the contract, unlike in the private world, in the federal government world, in almost every contract, there's going to be this FAR clause that says you must verify that the employees that you're planning to have on this contract, this is the day one of award, that they are U.S. citizens, as an example. You will find that within the first 30 days of the contract, there are things that the government wants from you that are not related to the work itself. So there are a lot of FAR clauses that you want to become very, very familiar with. Actually, you want to be familiar with it prior to award so that when you have to provide it within the first 30 days, you're able to do that and you know exactly what's required. So performing the work is very, very important, but also being sure you're in compliance with the FAR clauses is considered to be a part of that performance. Okay. So let's kind of go back now. I'm on page 21 where it talks about to bid or not to bid. So you've got an understanding now of how to respond to an RFP. And let's just go back to the point where you've read through the RFP thoroughly. You figured out what your action steps are. And you know which ones are required to respond to the RFP, and you know the ones that you have to do later. So once you have a sense of all of that, before you start responding, you should think about should you bid or not bid. And some of the things you should think about to help you make that decision is looking at the specification itself. If it's a product, it'll generally have specifications. If it's services, it's going to have the statement of work or the performance work statement. You want to look at that very, very closely. If it's the standard format that you see, standard form 1449, that's generally section C of the RFP. So take a look at that and say to yourself that, yes, you have strong capabilities in those areas. And if you do, then you want to make a to-bid decision as that step. Then you want to look at the delivery schedule, and you want to look at the location. If you're in Virginia and the work's in California, is that something that you want to do? Does that work within your business model? If it does, you bid, and if it doesn't, you don't. I'll skip through the next couple of ones on the sheet, but certainly that last one is super important. Is there an existing contract and there's an incumbent who already has a contract and is being recompeted, and is that incumbent bidding? So that's an important consideration, because if the incumbent is bidding, that means that you have to offer a superior product or a superior technical approach, and then your pricing has also got to be spot on to win. So those are the kinds of things you want to think about before you decide to bid or not. Now, I will say this, and I think it's important for those of you on the phone who are very serious about federal government contracting. You've made this, you have federal government contract as part of your business plan, and it's something that you very much want to do. I would tell you that it is in your best interest to try out RFPs and to bid on them well in advance of when you really want to win one, so that you could have gone through that process at least three times and you're able to see for yourself what your strengths or weaknesses are with respect to how well you respond. You want to have some practice in that. I would highly recommend that to you. And then you may recall when we got started on the webinar, I said this is all about preparation, getting ready to bid and then win. And so I think a part of that preparation ought to be that you go find some solicitations in FBO.gov and that your first one be a trial where you don't necessarily need to win it or want to win it, but you want to go through the process to see how ready you are for it. Highly recommend that to you. I will tell you that I have a client now where I prepare their responses to proposals for them, and I have for the last 7 or 8 months, and they've made a decision that I'm happy about for them to have their own team prepare the responses in the future in lieu of me doing it, so that they have that capability in-house. And I can tell you we're on solicitation number 2 with them preparing it versus my leading it and preparing it and all of that. And they have not yet fine-tuned that process. I would say they're about 50% there in terms of being able to do it by themselves. And so that's why I am very much encouraging you to try yourself out and see how long it takes you to get to the point where you feel very, very comfortable bidding on proposals yourself. Okay, let's move on to a second set of bid or no bid decisions. So I'm on page 22 of the slides. And you want to think about if this is a product. Is a first article required? Are there issues with compatibility to a product that's already being used by the government? But these last three bullets are super important. If this requirement that you're looking at in FBO.gov, this particular solicitation, has potential for your long-term business, then you definitely want to consider it strongly. And if you have the technical expertise, by all means, you want to consider a bid decision, but you need to have it and you need to be strong in it. Now, the reason that I highlight that is you have to remember when something is advertised in FBO.gov, it is open to any company in the entire United States if it is not a restricted requirement. For example, there could be a full and open competition, meaning any contractor, large or small, could bid. Or it could be a small business set-aside where only small businesses should bid. But in either one of those cases, that's still throughout the United States. So you have a lot of companies looking at this solicitation and planning to bid. It's not worth your effort to do it if you're not strong in it, because there are probably others that are. And once you go through these RFPs, you're going to find that they're very time-consuming in terms of hours to put together. And because they are, you want to use your time wisely and not go for things where you don't have strong technical expertise. And while I'm at this point, let me just qualify my statement a little bit. When it comes to bidding on a product, it's a lot easier to bid on that and a lot less time in terms of hours than it is when you're bidding on services. Services is the one that generally requires a lot more of your time and effort. And, of course, certainly the larger the dollar value, the more time it generally takes to prepare the proposal. All right? Last bullet on this page is past performance. If the solicitation says you need to have 3 years past performance on similar efforts in size and scope, if you don't have that, you don't want to bid. But if you do have it, then you want to bid. So these are all things you want to think about. Not every solicitation says you have to have past performance in doing it, but some, actually probably the majority of them, do. And so you're going to want to check that section. Now, let me bring up a very good point right here, and that is I want to reference 2 solicitations that came out today as good ones for you to look at to see the differences between RFPs, and also I'd like you to go to these 2 RFPs and look at Section L, Instructions to the Offeror. And it will give you an appreciation for everything we've talked about up until this point on the slides. And it will certainly hone in on these points that I'm making right now about the bid or not bid. So I'm going to say the number of these solicitations very slowly. I'll repeat them twice. The first one is called Barrier Studies. Barrier Studies. So it's a services RFP. And the RFP number is F as in Frank, C as in Charles, 12Q0009. I'll repeat that RFP number, FBB12Q0009. I'd like you to go to page 20 of that RFP, and you will see the instructions to the offeror. In there, it will tell you all of the things that are going to be required when you prepare your response, and there is some evaluation criteria that tells you how they're going to evaluate the proposal that you're putting together. The second one I'd like you to take a look at is for National Bank Examination Support Services. And that solicitation number is T as in Tom, C as in Charles, 12, H as in Hannah, Q, R as in Ray, 0006. And I'll repeat that number, T as in Tom, CC, 12, HQ, R, 0006, and I'd like you to look at page 58 of that one. Page 58 talks about the instructions to the offeror and everything that's required to respond to that RFP. I'm giving you these two RFPs to look at because they are fairly representative of the types of proposal requirements that you will likely see on most RFPs that you're planning to bid on if they're service related. And you'll see the similarities in the two when you read them. So I wanted to just kind of take a stopping point and tell you about those because you'll get a feel for the bid, not to bid, as well as how much effort it would take to respond to a government RFP. Okay, the last part of to bid or not to bid, I'm on page 23 of the slides, talks about you might want to consider teaming up with another company if you don't feel like you have the strongest expertise. Now, the government encourages teaming. They have no issue with that at all, and so you might want to do a joint venture or some kind of subcontractor arrangement. Another consideration on whether or not you want to go forward with responding is if you have the right personnel and if you're able to connect all the dots with respect to the task that's required and the deliverable. Okay, another couple of points. We're moving along. So once you have prepared the proposal, the next point for the contracting officer is to receive it and to decide if you've been responsive. And we talked about this a little bit earlier. So in order to be responsive, you need to fill out all the forms. You need to be sure you sign in the right place. You need to follow the solicitation format. That's section L or what other section that the RFP is telling you are the proposal instructions for preparing your response. You want to be sure you follow that exact format. You want to respond to their needs, no more, no less. The government is not concerned at all with you providing them with any additional information other than what they asked for. So that's what the no more means. Don't give them more than they asked for, but at the same time, don't give them less than they asked for. For example, if it says provide resumes, and you don't provide any, you're going to be non-responsive, and they're not going to consider your proposal at all. Be sure you send to the correct address, and you're going to see addresses in many different places, particularly on the SF-1449. You might see some addresses, but the instructions back in Section L might say send it here. So be sure you have the correct address for where it should go, and please send it in earlier than the day that it's due, just in case you have mail problems or anything like that. All right, so the first test of the contracting officer is, does this solicitation response that I received from the contractor, is it responsive? Now, assuming that it is, Then the next step that the contracting officer has to make is this contractor responsible now? All right? So now you've responded properly to the RFP. If it's a services contract, as an example, you've provided your technical approach, your management approach. You've done all of that. They've determined that you're in a competitive range, meaning you have a reasonable chance of getting the award. And now they have to determine, after they've decided all of that, are you a responsible contractor? Okay, and literally, I was a contracting officer for many, many years, and one of the things that we have to do as a contracting officer is make this responsibility determination and literally write a document to the file that's reviewed a level higher than the contracting officer and also reviewed by legal before the award is made. So a responsibility determination is a big deal. And the contracting officer has to be assured in some way that you can perform that contract. And so they make that determination based upon what you submitted. If there's not enough information in your response for them to do that, they may actually call some of your prior customers to see how well you performed, did you deliver on time, all of those kinds of things. So that's all about responsibility. And as I said earlier, you can subcontract part of that work out and use the responsibility of your subcontractor to help you with that. All right, so you're checking off all the blocks. You were responsive, you were responsible, and then the last piece is we have to determine that contracting officer has to determine if your price is reasonable. And once again, this is a document that the contracting officer has to write in their file, generally have it approved at a level higher than them. It's always reviewed by the legal department. And I want you to know this is a big deal area. I have written so many of these responsible determinations as a contracting officer. And generally speaking, it's pages long. So this is not one where we write just one paragraph. Contracting officers review every aspect of your pricing and make a determination as to whether or not it's reasonable or not. So this part is a big, big, big deal. And I will tell you that even for a large procurement, sometimes the contracting office, the entire contracting office, including the division chief, the head of contract, sometimes has to go a level above his agency, one level up, to get approval sometimes if the dollar value is large. So reasonable determination is truly pretty significant. All right? Now, sometimes if it's an IFB, which is an invitation for bid, then low price will win, but if it's an RFP, request for proposal, that means the government may award to a contractor that's the best value, meaning best technical, but not necessarily low price. And you'll know whether or not you're in either one of those situations when you read the evaluation criteria in the RFP. Okay, I'm pressing on. Now I want to talk about the whole source selection process and what is the process from beginning to end. So that you have an understanding of it, because I'm sure many of you have heard that sometimes it can take almost 6 months to get a contract awarded from the day you sent it in. And you're wondering, what in the world is going on in all that period of time? Well, I'm here to explain it to you. All right, so we've talked about the RFP being issued in SBO.gov. So I'm on the page that says source selection process, slide 27. The RFP comes out and the solicitation is issued. Sometimes they'll have a conference before the proposals are received and invite you to come to that to give you more specifics about the work. And if they do that, it'll say in FBO.gov that a conference is planned. They'll tell you all the details about it. Then the proposals will come in, and they immediately go off in two different directions. The first being, generally speaking, a technical evaluation team is established. Sometimes they call them source selection boards. And they'll review the technical aspects of your proposal. And then the cost evaluation part will stay with the contracting officer, and they'll start looking at your costs and whether or not they're reasonable and all of that. So your technical proposal is out, your cost proposal is out. They're evaluating all of that. And then comes the questions and discussion area. That's called the negotiation area. So for those, and then a competitive range decision is made, and then that means these are the companies that have a reasonable chance of getting the award and they're shortlisted. Okay? Now, this technical evaluation, cost evaluation part, the questions and discussion and getting to the competitive range can easily take 30 days sometimes, or sometimes longer. But generally speaking, within a 30-day range, they've gotten through that process. All right? So then you've got the contractors that have a reasonable chance of award. And generally speaking, that's 10 or less. Most times it's 5 or less. And so you'll start having site visits with them, right? And so those that have a reasonable chance of award get to meet the contracting officer. They get to provide oral presentations, all of that. There's clarity about where your proposal is great and where it's weak. And then you're given a chance to take that information from the site visit, take it back to your company, rewrite the aspects of your proposal that you want, and then provide an oral presentation to the contracting officer of all of your changes. And then you are allowed to submit a best and final offer. That's another 30 days, generally speaking. All right? So once your best and final offer is received, you then, there's then another technical evaluation, cost evaluation occurs. At least a couple of weeks on that, sometimes 3 weeks. And then the ultimate contractor is then selected at that point. And then there is final negotiations and award to the contract. So that's the process from beginning to end. And I can easily see how it takes 6 months to work through that whole thing. It certainly works a lot faster if it's smaller dollars or if it's a product. All right, I'm going to flash through these dues because I'm sure you all have been paying very close attention to what we've been talking about. So this is sort of a summary of the dues. You want to do a reverse timeline on how you're going to get to being responsive with the proposal in the mail to the contracting officer by a time frame. So if you know it's due on the 30th, you're going to know that by the 25th you want to put it in the mail, right? And so that means by the 20th you might want to have your cost part done. By the 15th you want to have your technical part done. So if you do a reverse timeline, it will help you not be so much at the last minute and getting it in the mail a day or two before it's due to the contracting officer. So doing a reverse timeline is a good thing. You want to address every requirement separately. You just really want to follow the instructions. Contracting officers are generally pretty good about, okay, on page 1, tab 1, tell me this. You know, on page 3, tell me this. You know, and they'll tell you, they'll give me what 5 pages for that section. So they generally will tell you how they're going to respond back. And we already talked about only give them what they ask for and no more. And it's so important to know your competitors' strengths and weaknesses. And I could give a whole webinar on that. There is a place where you can go and find out who your competitors are and what their pricing is, and all of that. That place is called GSAAdvantage.com. So if you happen to have a competitor who has a GSA schedule, all their pricing is there. But there's also something called the Federal Procurement Data System, FTDS.gov, where you can go there and in the easy search button, put in your contractor's name, and you can find all the contracts that they've been awarded and how much they were for, and period of performance, and a whole host of other things. Both of those two contract procurement systems are things that I hold true so dear to my heart because they have so much information. And if you guys want more information about that, actually, WIFS has done seminars on those, and webinars on those, and so have I. And so WIFS might be able to go to their database, or if you need to, feel free to contact me through Scott, and I can get you more information on those two systems, particularly FTDS.gov. All right? I think I've convinced you it's only right the ones you can win. That is so, so important. Don't, and when I say that, I want to give you that one qualifier again that I think you ought to do some trial ones. But once you've done your trial ones, then only write the ones you can win because you will find through your trials that it does take a lot of time and effort. you want to pick the right person to do it. If you're very serious about it, you might want to actually find someone who's very adept. There are consultants out there who are very adept at writing proposals, winning proposals. You might want to consider that as an alternative. Another is, you know, find someone, find a mentor who you know has done it many, many times and have them assist you with it also. Might be a good thing to do. You do want to have a proposal, detailed proposal outline. That outline ought to follow exactly what the instructions are. And you always want to go for the highest score, particularly if you're in a competitive situation. So write your proposal to get the highest evaluation points. I think I've done slide 30 pretty good in terms of the dues. I believe we've also talked to this one, slide 31, about being uniform in how you present your material. And definitely consider pricing inflation. You know, if this is a five-year effort, you don't want your price, you need to factor in your pricing so that it covers your cost for the whole 5 years. So maybe you want to average your cost over what you think they might be over a five-year period of time, because you don't get to change your price, right? All right. And then let's summarize what we talked about. You want to read the RFP. That is my main message, and read it three times. You want to think about using teaming partners if you don't have the full scope of capability that's needed. Absolutely every time, go to the proposal preparation instruction part of the RFP as the first thing you do, and then right after that, look at the evaluation criteria. They are the two main parts of any RFP. If you want to have a complete handle on, read those sections first, and be sure you have a handle on what's required, and that will help you with your bid, no bid. All right, now, this is interesting here. Whether you win or lose, you want a debriefing. Even if you win, the whole point of the debriefing is to tell you how well you responded to the RFP. And if there were any parts of the RFP that you were deficient in, you want to get all of that feedback from the contracting officer. So always ask for a debriefing. Now, please keep this in mind. You only have 3 days after receiving notice that you didn't win or win to ask for a debriefing. That can be via an email or it can be in writing, but you only have 3 days to do it per the federal acquisition regulation. So you can't do it a week later or anything like that. They have no responsibility to debrief you on how well you prepared your proposal if you miss that time frame. So please keep that in mind. And what you're seeing on slide 33 are the questions you want to ask about your proposal. And I think these are excellent, excellent questions. So by all means, use them when you're in a debriefing situation, right? And just look at the questions here. You know, you want to know, how did you do on cost? You know, if 10 people bid, were you number 10, or, you know, where were you in that whole process? So there's just so much to be learned from a debriefing. And it's very, very important to be very positive about the whole debriefing experience. Don't, you know, be on the defensive. I don't understand how I could have not won this thing. I don't think you were being fair, you know, whatever the case may be. You want to be very, very positive about, you know, how you're talking to the contracting officer, so you can learn as much as you can so that you can get better on the next one. Or even if you won, you want to know what were your strong points that made you win, because they're the same ones you're going to want to capitalize on when you bid on other proposals. Okay, does anyone have any questions of me? I'll have to tell you, this is the first time I've done a webinar and I haven't had any questions. Is that the case, Scott?
Oh, not at all. We have quite a few of
them. Oh, okay. I'm ready.
And I will let everyone know if we run out of time and we don't get to everyone's questions. I will forward them to Barbara, and don't worry, we'll get them answered for you. And if you have any further questions, please email them to me at snolen at WIPP.org. That's snolan@wip.org. So let's get right to it, Barbara. The first question is from Lori. She asks if you could explain first article testing.
Yes. It's only for products. Sometimes the government wants to buy a state-of-the-art kind of product, and before they accept that product, they want to test it first. So it's basically like build us a prototype that meets the specifications, and then we're going to test it to see whether or not it met our needs. So first article is like a prototype. And if the government accepts it, then you can go build the rest of them. But if they say, nope, that didn't do it, then your contract is stopped. That's a good question.
Okay. The next one is, where do you find Form 1449?
FBO.gov. FBO.gov, pull up any solicitation, and most of them will be in that format. And that's an excellent question, too, because another way to find it is to Google it. What I have found is amazing. As far as federal government contracting goes, and actually almost anything these days, you can Google anything that I talked about today. Just Google the phrase, and it will come up in come up on Google, and you can find it. So you can find it either on FBO.gov or you can Google, and it will come up. Because another place to find it, by the way, is in the FAR. Section 53 of the FAR are all standard forms, and so you'll also find it there.
Okay, my next question is from Liz. She asks, is getting a call to negotiate or get feedback a usual occurrence from the contract officer?
Oh, repeat that one for me, Scott. I didn't quite get that.
Sure. She asks, is getting a call to negotiate or get feedback a usual occurrence from the contract officer?
If you're in a competitive range, yes. If you're not, no. You generally will just get a letter in the mail that says, we just awarded this contract to ... at this price, and thank you for bidding, and good luck next time. There is a clause in every solicitation that says the government reserves the right to award a contract with or without discussions, right? And so most of the time when it comes to a competitive one where there's evaluation criteria, there's always some level of negotiations, right? But for products, a lot of times you don't get that opportunity to negotiate. They go straight to award. So you only get to negotiate if you're within that top five. Otherwise, you won't hear from the contracting officer.
Okay, my next question is, from Liz. She says, I am responding to a source's thought for up to 15 pages. What I prepare, like what is being described in this presentation, or is there something else I should keep in mind?
That's another good question. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I want to tell you why you see so many sources thought in the last couple of years when you didn't see so many in the past. Sources thought are the contracting officer's way of deciding how they're going to put out the solicitation that comes after that. And so if they get a lot of good sources sought responses, as an example, from women-owned businesses, they may do a women-owned set-aside. Or if they get enough from a small business, they may do a small business set-aside or any of the other categories. So I do want to encourage everybody on the phone to always respond to sources sought, because it is a huge factor in how the RFP comes out in terms of whether or not it's a set-aside. So, no, there aren't any additional pointers on a source of thought. You kind of want to follow the same process that we talked about here. The only difference, obviously, in a source of thought is you don't provide pricing as a general rule. So you're providing your capabilities. It's generally a lot less cumbersome than responding to an RFP. If you're doing 15 pages in a source of thought, that's telling me that's probably a very rather complicated, large dollar kind of response. Typically, you know, a source of thought, it could be anywhere from 3 to 10 pages, and more generally along the 3 to 3 pages versus the 10. But sometimes they ask for a whole lot, and it sounds like that's your particular situation. And in that case, you really want to follow the rules and tidbits that we talked about today.
Okay, my next question is from Patricia. She asks, What if since the release of the solicitation, during negotiations for those in the competitive range, changes have been made or clarifications to the SOW which all parties have agreed to? How is that incorporated into the final contract?
Anytime the government makes a change, they always follow it up with an amendment to the solicitation. So you would immediately, if there was a statement of work change, there would be an amendment changing that statement of work. So any change that the government makes, they always make it official by amending the solicitation. They're called, we call them like pools, because they started with a P, as in Paul, so it would be pool one, pool two, however many pools they need to do is generally how they do that. And that also reminds me to tell you that you have to acknowledge every one of those amendments on the SF-1449. And if you don't, you are considered non-responsive, and they will not look at your bid. And it says that, but again, this is one of those things where there's so much to read, you might miss that. So every time an amendment is issued, write on that form. And by the way, amendments are issued also on the SF-1449. So instead of having the solicitation number, we'll have this pool one that I'm talking about, or whatever the next pool number is. And right on that form, it'll say you must acknowledge and sign that you received this change to the contract. That's a good question.
Okay. Next question I have from Patricia. She asks, how do you know for sure that an incumbent is bidding, or how can you tell if an incumbent is bidding on an existing contract?
That's an excellent question. Let me just tell you a statistic. About 40% of everything the government buys is a repeat buy. And so if it's for services, you can generally tell just by reading it that it's not a first-time buy. If it's a first-time buy, you can kind of gather that through the reading of the statement of work, because they sometimes provide a background. And so they'll kind of say, you know, for the last 10 years, we've been doing da-da-da-da-da-da. So reading it through the statement of work is generally the way that you would know. And I'm so glad you brought up that question, because there's another opportunity for you to find out. What I'm seeing lately is on a lot of solicitations that are coming out, it'll say, if you have any questions, submit your questions by a certain time in writing to the contracting officer, and they will respond back in FBO.gov to everybody with the answer. That is a question you should always ask. Always. Is there an incumbent? And if there is one, they will tell you. They will tell you who the incumbent is. They'll even give you the contract number. And then you can go to FTDS.gov, put in that contractor name or contract number, and you can find out exactly what the price was. That's an excellent question. Thanks for asking that.
And I believe we just have time for one more question. If you did not get your question answered, I will forward those to Barbara to make sure everyone gets their questions answered. And if you have further questions, please feel free to email them to me, and I will get them to Barbara. And my last question here is from Liz. She asks, from your experience, what is a realistic time expectation to expect from when you submit your first proposal and thereafter and actually getting an award?
I love you all's questions. There is a rule of thumb about that, and the rule of thumb is, if this is your first time going after a government contract, it generally takes a year. So that means you might not get your first one, you might not get your second one, you might not get your third one, and it might take a year to get your first government contract. There truly is an art to federal government contracting, and it is a learning process. You know, if you are a company that's been in business for 15 or 20 years and you've had a large amount of sales on the private side and you are leaping into federal government contracting for the first time, it might take you a little bit less time than that one-year point, but that's a good marker for how long it would generally take. I will tell you that attending, being a part of webinars like this and engaging with web, I cannot tell you how incredibly good the WIFS Give Me 5 program is. It is phenomenal. I can tell you, before I retired from the federal government as a contracting officer and before came into being and Give Me Five came into being, there was no such, all of this expertise and tools on how to be successful with federal government contracting did not exist. But now you have all of these tools. WIPP has a library of topics on how to be successful in government contracting. Every month they've got a topic that's good. So I think you can shorten that time a whole lot if you participate in the places, webinars, seminars, workshops where good information is. And I recommend WIPP over any other organization because theirs is incredibly comprehensive. And another thing you could do is you can consider, you know, hiring a consultant to jumpstart you and get it done faster. That's also another alternative. Scott, thank you so much for sharing those questions with me. If there are any others, Scott, I'm sure we'll pass them on to me, and I'd be happy to answer them. And I encourage all of you to participate in Part 2 and Part 3. Believe it or not, we just scratched the surface in this one. And in Part 2, we're going to dig deeper and give you more technical points, a lot more things to concern yourself with in terms of being successful. The whole pricing part that I talk about, how to price a government contract, is hard. That's hard, and but I can tell you how to do it in a way that works. So definitely stay tuned for Part 2 and Part 3.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara, and I just want to once again let everyone know if your question was not answered, I will forward that on to Barbara to make sure it gets answered. Also, I want to thank Barbara for her really outstanding presentation and thank everyone on the line for joining us. And once again, if you have any additional questions, email them to me at snolan@wipp.org and I'll pass them along. One that I encourage everyone to please take a moment to share your thoughts on the brief feedback survey that will accompany the presentation links via email you should be receiving in the next couple of days. The presentation will also be posted on giveme5.com under the Resources tab. Give Me Five is part of a larger program series, Women, Money, and Opportunity, which brings you a wide range of resources to educate women business owners. And please check our program websites for upcoming webinars. And as Barbara said, don't forget to sign up for Part 2 of this series, Give Me Five 129, How to Write Successful Proposals Part 2, on Wednesday, April 11th, 2012 at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, and you'll have another opportunity to ask Barbara some more questions then. WIPP is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy organization advocating on behalf of nearly 1 million women-owned businesses, representing 60 business organizations. And don't forget to get involved. If you have any questions, please feel free to contact the WIPP staff. I want to thank you again, Barbara, and thank everyone for joining us today. Have a wonderful day. Goodbye.